When the wife of Uriah heard that her husband had died, she made lamentation for him. The story is only told from one perspective. The central character is my namesake, the King of Israel. He is the one on whom the text focuses. He is the one whose sin is called out by the prophet Nathan. He is the one who writes Psalm 51 in the aftermath of this encounter. He is the one that this story is about. His is the perspective that matters. 16 years ago, the good people at VeggieTales released the story entitled King George and the Ducky on VHS. Remember VHS? In the story, King George and the Ducky, which is telling this story of Bathsheba and all of those around her, in the VeggieTales world, the emphasis is still on the king and what he has done. Bathsheba herself is represented by a rubber duck, which can only squeak and is fought over by two male characters. That representation of Bathsheba is representative of most attempts to tell this story. I would like to try to tell this story from Bathsheba's perspective. Now, to be fair, this will take some imagination, because the biblical text does not tell us much about Bathsheba and her story. We will have to read between the lines. We will have to be creative. We will have to take the risk of allowing our own biases to influence our reading of the text. But Bathsheba's voice needs to be heard. Because buried in her story is a profound lesson on reconciliation. What do we know about Bathsheba? Well, the author of 2 Samuel is kind enough to tell us that she is very beautiful. What else do we know about her? We know she is a real person. We know that she has a real history and a real family. We know that her father's name is Eliam, and we know that her husband is Uriah the Hittite. Both of these men are listed 12 chapters later in 2 Samuel 23 among David's 30 famous fighting mighty men. These are military guys. Bathsheba is a military daughter and a military wife. You know how the story goes. Bathsheba is washing herself after her monthly period, as all other Israelite women did every 4 weeks. It was completely normal. And because of Middle Eastern social concerns, Bathsheba would have been bathing herself in a private location, concealed from the rest of society. But she is seen by the king. Now, centuries of interpreters, not all of them, but many of them, throughout the centuries, have assumed that Bathsheba was naked or was somehow exposing herself in public, perhaps even to draw attention to herself from the king. But the text never suggests that. And ancient Israelite culture would not allow for that. Bathsheba is innocent in all of this. Amen. The king sees her, sends for her, takes her, sleeps with her, impregnates her, and then tries to cover it all up. The king tries to get Bathsheba's husband, Uriah, to come home and sleep with her so that he would believe that the child is his. But Uriah will not do that out of loyalty to his fellow soldiers. So the king sends Uriah back to the front lines, carrying a message to Joab, the commander of the Israelite army. And in that message, carried by Uriah himself, Joab finds instructions to leave Uriah exposed on the front lines of battle and to let him die at the hand of the enemy. This happens. The king has now exposed two people who should not have been exposed. The king is finally told that Uriah the Hittite is dead. All of this takes place in 2 Samuel 11 with no emotional content. There are no descriptions of how people feel or react to any of these events until we get to verse 26, when Uriah's wife heard that her husband was dead. She mourned for him. So let's start again. Can you imagine? Bathsheba has lived a perfectly normal life. Her father is in the military. She has married a military man, an immigrant from another people group, the Hittites. She has been busy living her life as a normal Israelite person in Jerusalem until the king sees her and sleeps with her. Now, Bathsheba is carrying the king's child. She has been wronged. Bathsheba speaks two words to the king, words which will change her life forever. I'm pregnant. And now she stands widowed because of the direct action of the man who got her pregnant. She has been wronged. The text never assigns blame to Bathsheba for what has happened. The king is the one to blame. The next chapter makes that clear. The prophet Nathan comes and rebukes the king for taking the wife of another man and having that man killed. Bathsheba has been wronged. And then the king says, I have sinned against the Lord. And then he writes Psalm 51, which says, against you, Lord, you only have I sinned. Really? Was there no one else in this story who was hurt by the king's actions? Once more and again, Bathsheba has been wronged. Bathsheba's child, a son, whose name we never learn. Perhaps he was never named, dies in his infancy. This is seen in the text as God's punishment on the king for his sins. And while the text focuses its attention on the king's grief, surely Bathsheba grieves another death, the death of her son. She has been wronged. And then, the man who got her pregnant, the man who had her husband killed, the man who was the reason her child died, that same man comforts her and sleeps with her again. Bathsheba conceives again, and this time we do learn the name of the child, Solomon, who will grow up to succeed his father as the king of Israel. Can you imagine being Bathsheba? Now, I don't mean to ask if you can imagine the victimhood of Bathsheba. We use the word victim a lot these days, and I've started to realize in some situations the word victim, when it's used to apply to a person, can actually reduce the personhood of the person that we're talking about. Bathsheba is more than a victim. She's a person. So I don't mean to ask, can you imagine her victimhood? I mean to ask, can you imagine her personhood? Can you imagine living as Bathsheba had to live for the rest of her life, living the rest of her days as the wife of an adulterous, murderous man who caused her so much grief? Bathsheba outlives the king. 1 Kings chapter 2 shows that she is still living when the king dies. So from the day of her first husband's death to the day of her second husband's death, Bathsheba lives in the household of a man who has wronged her. Can you imagine? Can you imagine the forgiveness? Can you imagine the reconciliation? Can you imagine Bathsheba making peace with the king, with the death of her son, with the death of her husband? Can you imagine Bathsheba picking up the pieces of her life and finding a new normal in which to live? Can you imagine Bathsheba being happy? You have to imagine all of these things, because the text never tells us any of them. The text only shows that Bathsheba stays in the king's royal court for many years. Many years. Forgiveness and reconciliation do not take place overnight. They take time, and they take lots of emotional and relational work. In the course of my studies here at the seminary in the past couple of years, I've been required to read a couple of books by Desmond Tutu, an Anglican bishop from South Africa. He writes extensively about his work in South Africa, his home nation, in the aftermath of apartheid to bring about reconciliation and forgiveness in a country that was deeply divided. His writings are profound. He tells powerful stories of people forgiving people who had killed their family members. But that forgiveness takes time. You may remember last summer, has it been that long, when a gunman opened fire in an historical African-American church in Charleston, South Carolina. 9 people were killed in the span of 6 minutes after their Wednesday evening Bible study. One of the most beautiful moments in the wake of that tragedy came in the courtroom, where family members of the victims were invited to speak in the presence of the gunman who was watching by video feed. One family member after another expressed, through their grief, their forgiveness of the one who had wronged them. It was amazing to watch. Now, I don't know any of those individuals personally. Perhaps you do, perhaps you don't. But I'm fairly certain that their work of forgiveness, while expressed in that moment, will take a long time. It was not over when the video feed clicked off. Moving forward, living into the future, dealing with the pain of the past is a process that takes time. But reconciliation, when it is done well, is a beautiful thing. This is not just a biblical truth, though. We as Christians do not have a corner on the market of forgiveness and reconciliation. Our culture knows the meaning and the power of forgiveness and reconciliation. An extremely popular musical, currently showing on Broadway, makes a dramatic statement about the beauty of forgiveness and reconciliation toward the end of the show. This show won multiple Tony Awards this year, a Grammy Award, and even the Pulitzer Prize for drama. I'm talking, of course, about Hamilton, the hip-hop musical about the life and times of Alexander Hamilton, a veteran of our Revolutionary War, and the first Secretary of the Treasury in our nation's history. The show is incredibly popular, and if you want to see it, you can go to New York City after buying a secondhand ticket on StubHub for about $300 or $400 for a seat way back in the nosebleeds. You can still see it if you wish. I chose, on the other hand, to buy the soundtrack for $25. So call me frugal. But the CD contains the libretto, so you can understand all the lyrics, and it's really very clever and a lot of fun. In fact, I listened to the whole thing on the trip down here from Michigan Sunday. It was, I don't know, it's just kind of fun. Toward the end of Hamilton, we catch a glimpse of a beautiful act of forgiveness. I'd like to play for you the song which portrays this reconciliation, but first, let me set the stage. Alexander Hamilton is married to a woman named Eliza. They have a son named Philip. But while Eliza and Philip are away for the summer, visiting with her sister Angelica and the family, Alexander begins an adulterous relationship with another married woman. Alexander pays off that woman's husband financially, so he will keep quiet about the affair. But eventually, Alexander's enemies learn about his misdeeds. So in an effort to clear his political name, Alexander Hamilton writes and publishes a paper in which he describes his adultery and the subsequent payments of money. This is how his wife Eliza learns that her husband has cheated on her. They don't divorce, but they do separate. In due time, their son Philip, now 19 years old, challenges a man to a duel because that man spoke poorly of Alexander, Philip's father. Philip is killed in the duel. And now this.
In the street, walking by your side, talking by your side.
Can you imagine? Forgiveness. Can you imagine Bathsheba forgiving David? Can you imagine her moving ahead, reconciling with herself and with her family all that she has lost, all of the wrongs that she has experienced? We have to imagine, because the text does not tell us. But it comes close. The book of Proverbs is attributed to King Solomon, Bathsheba's son. In the final chapter of that book, we find the sayings of a King Lemuel, an unusual name. It means belonging to God. It only appears there. We have no record anywhere else of a King Lemuel. A long-held Jewish tradition is that King Lemuel is another name for King Solomon, Bathsheba's son. So listen to these words from Proverbs 31, verses 1 through 9. The words of King Lemuel, an oracle that his mother taught him. Oh, my son, oh, son of my womb, oh, son of my vows, do not give your strength to women, your ways to those who destroy kings. It is not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine, or for rulers to desire strong drink, or else they will drink and forget what has been decreed and will pervert the rights of all the afflicted. Give strong drink to the one who is perishing, and wine to those in bitter distress. Let them drink and forget their poverty and remember their misery no more. Speak out for those who cannot speak, for the rights of all the destitute. Speak out, judge righteously, defend the rights of the poor and needy. Can you imagine Bathsheba forgiving, learning wisdom, speaking up, and doing the hard work of reconciliation? Can you hear her voice? Biblical reconciliation does not occur in a moment. It takes a lifetime of growth and sorrow and patience and wisdom. So I challenge you, in your biblical studies, allow unheard voices to speak. And in your relationships, pursue the long work of reconciliation with those who have wronged you.